This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl. Thank you so much for joining us wherever you are in the world. Right here in Australia where we're recording, it is getting cold in some parts. And we have a question today about how we layer our clothes when it gets colder. Think about that as we head into the episode. Are you someone who maybe wears one layer on the bottom, a couple layers on the top? We're going to potentially get into why that is. And we may need your help with it too. Dr. Carl also gives us an update on 3i Atlas, and we get a question to kick us off from a friend of the show. Let's get into it. Across from me, the man, the myth, the legend, Dr. Carl. Carl, how you doing?
I'm feeling awfully embarrassed by that very big wind-up. I don't feel worthy, but
no!
Thank you so much.
You are so worthy. And not only that, you have been a bit of a celeb this week. You called into breakfast with Jordan and Luca on Monday as they announced that they would be taking over Drive. You were pumping iron. You had some really great notes of wisdom for Jordan moving into a new show in the afternoon. But that also means that Conchetta is leaving. And this morning, Dr. Carl, Chet had her last question for you. Do you want to hear it?
Lay it on us, Dr. Conchetta.
Okay, here's my question. What's the meaning of life, mate? Can you get him to answer that one?
I find the context of this one really funny. Here we have a girl who is just kind of at the end of her run. She's had so many early wake-ups. She's got one more to go and she wants to know.
Okay, here's my question. What's the meaning of life, mate? Can you get him to answer that one?
So with that energy. Dr. Carl, what is the meaning of life?
Well, Douglas Adams thought it was 42 and we'll just leave that one there by itself. Although by a coincidence, it is equal to the Hubble constant in miles per second, but we will just leave that aside.
What do you mean? Or should, okay.
Expansion of the universe. Oh. And the rate at which the universe expands is 42 miles per second for every 3 and a bit million light years away that something is from us. So a galaxy 3 and a bit million light years away is moving away at 42 miles per second from us. It's being carried by the expanding space, and you double or 10 times the distance, you double or 10 times the speed. Okay, we'll get 42 out of the way. Secondly, I'm kind of thinking from talking with various members of my family and being through a few things, is it's life is kind of like beer. You don't own it, you only rent it. You know, it comes in your mouth and then it goes out through, you know, your bladder, and then the beer's gone. And life is something that you wink
so
into and you wink out of it again. And then you're thinking, well, what's the point? And it's not to have as many toys as possible when you die, but I think to try to make life better for other humans around you, and not just the humans but the environment and the people. On the other hand, there's nothing wrong with having a few toys, but on the other hand, you don't want to do it to the extent that, you know, a tiny number of billionaires have as much wealth as half the planet.
Mm.
You know, so there's a balance there.
Okay. So the meaning of life
is to be kind.
You,
I'm like, that's so wussy.
You rent it, you don't own it, yeah. But it's to be kind and to, yeah, yeah. I see that. I see that through your lens as well, Dr. Carl.
Yeah, look, I might have spent too much time when I was a hippie reading Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Buddhist, all that sort of hippie stuff. Sorry.
Oh, but that's beautiful. I think she can take that into the next phase, be kind, and she's got bucket loads of
and
kindness.
What's her next phase?
Well, we don't know.
We don't know. That's what life is.
Yeah.
Like, I really thought it was going to be sunny today, but it was rainy. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Surprises.
We don't know. She is going to be catching up on sleep, but then taking her first trip to Italy. She's Italian and she's never actually been back to the motherland. So that is something that's on the horizon for her.
I remember we went to Rome for a week and we didn't even touch the surface.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. And we were in the queue at the taxi stand, and there was an American couple who had just flown and landed into Rome in the late afternoon, and they're going to be leaving Rome next morning. And so they're going to see all of Rome between midnight and dawn.
Oh,
no way.
Absolutely not.
It's just amazing. Like, you just sort of walk down the street and then there's this wall that's 2,000 years old, and you go into the largest concrete arch structure in the world, built 2,000 years ago. It's just amazing. She's going to have a ball.
I'm going in September. I can't wait. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
What's your favourite Italian food?
Gnocchi. I'm a real sucker for gnocchi that just sort of melts in the mouth with a little bit of porcini. In Rome, I had the first ever live porcinis. I've only had them dried. It was just amazing. Anyway.
Okay. Dave in Rockhampton, what's your favourite Italian food?
Spaghetti.
A classic. Spaghetti. We love it, Dave. Now, we're not going to, you know, I've taken us off course, but we are, of course, talking science. Dave in Rockhampton, you are our first question today. What do you want to know?
G'day, doctors. My question is, so Australia's got the oldest rocks and rock formations in the world, and I was just wondering, why are they the oldest when the Earth was formed at the same time?
It's tectonic plate activity. So the Earth's crust gets recycled. So to give you an overview, the Earth is a ball and about 12,500 kilometres across. And if you start at the surface, it's about 6,000 kilometres to the centre. Now, the crusty solid bit is maybe 6 to 100 kilometres thick, varying. And then underneath that is molten, gloopy rock, down to about halfway down, 3,000 kilometres. And then you keep on going, you run into a ball of liquid iron and then solid iron. So we're on the crust, and for at least, I think, 3 billion years, the crust has been moving around. Now, the geologists have a term, and I'm very weak on geology, the geologists have a term called a craton, C-R-A-T-O-N, which is a very old lump of rock. And it turns out that while many parts of the world have, you know, bits of really, really old rock, like 3.8 billion years old, Australia's got big fat chunks of it. And they seem to have been protected by roots going down into that malty, gloopy stuff. So there are parts of Australia where there hasn't been a lot of recycling of the surface, whereas in other countries there's a lot. And I remember we were in my four-wheel driving phase, up in the top left-hand corner of Australia, we saw these black mountains called the King Leopold Mountains. And they were, I thought, there's something weird, but I wish I was a geologist and I don't know anything about it. It turns out they were 600 million years of being continuously exposed. And they're apparently some of the oldest continuously exposed rocks. So lots of the world, geologically speaking, from my poor understanding, has old rock. We've got big slabs of it. And I think one of the oldest is in Western Australia, about halfway up, third of the way up, called Jack Hills. And that's also where we've found, 3.8 billion years old, very, very, very strong hints of ancient life that existed back then. Is that kind of helping you with my inadequate knowledge?
Yeah, for sure. That was a great explanation. Thanks.
Thank you so much for being kind, Dr. Dave. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. We've got Nat in Greenbank. Now, Nat, talk us through these differences between shade. What's your theory?
Okay, so I've noticed when it's really hot, if you find some shade from, say, under a pergola or a shade sail, it doesn't feel that refreshing or cooling. But if you're standing under a tree, even if it's like dappled shade, not full shade, it feels a lot more refreshing.
Agreed, Matt.
I'm trying to figure out, you know, that because, like, the water evaporates from the tree and puts water particles in the air, or what's going on there?
You're right, because it is a bit of a mystery. On one hand, you've got this solid shade from a building and there's absolutely zero light coming directly from the sun.
Yeah.
And then you go into the shade of a tree and it's not as black and dark and it's also dappled, but blow me down, it feels cooler. And by the way, just for fun, next time you go into the shade of a tree, take a sheet of paper with you and look at the colour of the shade, and you'll see, if you look carefully, that it's not sort of uniformly sort of like blackish, is actually white light minus the green, which is purple. So if you look at a sheet of paper in the shade of a tree, you're getting a bit of a purple hint. And you mentioned one of the two factors, which is the evaporation. So the tree sucks the water up and then sends it out into the world. But also associated with that is the second factor, which is you've got movement of air associated with the water going up. So they're the two major factors. And on the other hand, I have read a statement by one of the biggest property developers in Australia who said that they would remove all the trees from all the cities if the governments wouldn't stop. So if the governments would get out of the way. You know, and in parking lots, they throw out the trees and so we get this extra heat in areas. And Sydney did briefly have the record back in 2020 of being the hottest place on Earth. I think it was on the 4th of January in the year 2020. So we need the shade.
We need that greenery.
We need the greenery. It makes you feel good.
So, Nat, correct?
Nat is correct. You got the answer. You deserve the cardboard medal of honour, Dr. Nat.
All right. You guys have a fantastic day.
Aw, thanks, Nat. We have a bit of an update on 3i Atlas. Before we get into the development, do you want to just give us a bit of context? What is it?
So we humans have lived on Earth for about 300,000 years as humans, and we had astronomy going for maybe 10, oh, actually, much longer. Have you heard of the stars called the Seven Sisters?
Yeah.
But if you go and look at them with your naked eye, all you see is six.
Where's the seventh?
50,000 years ago, you could see seven. They moved a little bit. So that means we've kept that name, the Seven Sisters, for 50,000 years in different cultures around the world. And then, so that's a bit of a history of, you know, keeping an eye on the stars. And then we've found three objects coming from outer space. Oh, by the way, Copernicus, 15, 1600s, we realised that the sun is the centre of our little solar system, and we realised that the Earth's not the centre of the universe, blah, blah, blah. And then we've found three objects coming in from outer space. And on one hand, there's Professor of Astronomy or Physics at Harvard, Avi Loeb, L-O-E-B, who claims that anything is proof of interstellar intelligence. Hey, the sun woke up this morning. Okay, there's aliens out there. And so he reckons it's an alien object, but there's no evidence for that. And it came through our solar system and then whipped past the sun and went out again. And we've been looking at it carefully, and we've found it's actually about three times the age of the Earth. So the Earth's about 4.5 billion years old, and it's 12.8 billion years old, we reckon. Sorry, 12 billion years old, which is close to the age of the universe, which is 13.88. So it's really, really old, and we worked this out by analysing the light. And that first result just came through. So there may be aliens, but we've got no proof of it, but we're just... That's the little update, and there'll be a few more papers coming out on it.
Okay,
so there's
wow.
a little update on 3i Atlas, 3i standing for third interstellar object that we found. Atlas, the name of the astronomy system that found it.
We've had a few questions about it too. If ever you want to listen back, we have some episodes literally with 3i Atlas in the title. You can search that wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, Science with Dr. Carl, you can listen back to anytime. I'm Lucy. This is Greg in Eora, Sydney. Greg, what's your question?
Good morning, doctors. My question is, why is there such an increase in shark attacks?
There does seem to be a bit of an increase in shark attacks in that they're reported more in the papers, but the number of shark attacks is so low that three in 1 year or three in 6 months suddenly is so much more when you've had a 10-year period of having no shark attacks. And so I remember myself when I was working at Prince Henry Hospital in Little Bay in Sydney, I'd jump out of the hospital at lunchtime, go for a swim across the bay, and somebody was waving at me when I came out, and they were looking down at me from the cliff, and they said, when you jumped in the water and then you swam across the bay 200 metres and swam back again, this shark, roughly 1.5 times your body length, came up parallel to you, stayed parallel to you all the way across, maybe 2 metres away, and then you chucked a Yui and it went out to sea. So it could have been a shark attack statistic. So we're seeing even just small increases is just a huge increase over the long periods of zero. Then the other side of the coin is that we're having changes to the currents. Australia is the only continent where the water flows from the equator to the pole on each side. Every other continent, Africa, North America, South America, Asia, there's one up and one down. So we've got water coming from the equator, warm water on both the west coast and the east coast, and this current has been increasing. And so on one hand, we've found that it's increased so much that in Hobart, the seaweed forests, the kelp forests, are dying from the unexpected hot water. And along with those changes are changes in fish. And then the sharks follow the fish, and we just happen to be in the water. So there does seem to be an increase, but we're looking at maybe three attacks over 6 months. Let's have a better look over, say, 10 years. But that's no consolation to anybody who's been scared and thrown out the water by the drones and the alarms. And there was a terrible thing in Sydney, if people didn't know, just at a beach that was, you know, thought to be very safe.
Yeah, Coogee Beach between the flags. Greg, thanks for your question. Does that help?
Yes, it does help. Thank you.
Thank you. We got Carly in Wynnum here. Dr. Carly, got a question about Venus.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you doing?
That's good. So my question is, does Venus shine brightly in the sky at night all year round, or does it only shine brightly in the winter months in the southern hemisphere? Because I've noticed that it's exceptionally bright at the moment. And so, yeah, that's my question.
Okay, so looking at the solar system, you've got the Sun in the centre, then Mercury, then Venus, and we're the next one out. So if it's nighttime, well, that means we're in the shade and, you know, the sun's throwing shade on us. And if you look out into the dark, you ain't going to see some Venus because it's in towards the sun from us. So the only time we can see it is sunrise and sunset. And I think, but I'm not sure, but from memory, it was the Greeks who first realised that it was the same object at sunrise and sunset. Separately from that, sometimes it's really close to us and sometimes it's a bit further around the curve of the Earth. And I don't know where it is at the moment, whether it's as close as it can be to us, but I'm guessing that when it's really close to us, then it's really bright. And by the way, Captain Cook, his main job, one of his main jobs in coming to Australia, was to measure how far it was to the sun, which he did by going to Tahiti and seeing Venus cross the surface of the sun. And a bunch of measurements of that event around the world would help the British Navy work out the distance to the sun, which made them have better navigational maps. So I'm covering up the fact I don't know the answer to your question. If there's an astronomer type person, can you ring in and let us know if that's the case? So you're saying it's brighter now or brighter in the winter months or the summer months?
I think it's brighter at the moment. I really noticed it at the moment. So yeah, I think maybe because it's closer to Earth at the moment, but it definitely is brighter at the moment, I think.
Okay, so I'm guessing there's a 51% chance that it, as its closest approach to us.
I feel like there I was in New Zealand a couple of weeks ago, Carly, and I feel like it was brighter in the sky.
Yeah,
Come on down, audience, give us the answer.
Now, Alice, not only did you send in a question for Science with Dr. Carl, girl, you've just given birth. Like, no one has any excuse when I got Alice here with a fresh week-old baby, okay? Alice, congratulations, firstly. How'd it go?
Oh, look, it was a roller coaster, but we're both happy and healthy now, so it's good. It's
congratulations.
Good.
And even amongst you had a question for your midwife. What did you want to now put to Dr. Carl?
So before she was born, we were wondering why when babies are in the uterus and head down, why doesn't all the blood pool in their head and make them super uncomfortable? Oh. My OB and my midwife didn't actually know. So,
Dr. Carl, can you answer the question?
There's a few things. The first thing is that when a baby is born, what evolution is trying to do is get that baby born with the minimum of bad side effects. So the baby is born with a big head and the legs don't really count much. And so if you compare the ratio between the belly button and the top of the head and then the belly button and the feet, babies have got nothing compared to adults. And so there's not much there below the belly button. And you can chuck that on later. But the brain, that's really important to preserve. So the first thing is that the heart is closer to the centre of their body than in an adult. The second thing is that they're floating in their own urine, so they've been basically drinking their own urine for the last 9 months.
Ew.
And yuck, I know, it's yucky, isn't it? You can gross them out when they get old enough to understand that concept. And that relieves the pressure to some degree. And then finally, they're not using their lungs for gas exchange. There's not a lot of blood going through the lungs. In fact, virtually none. The only thing exercising the lungs are the hiccups, which we've talked about before, which are a training mechanism for the lungs to work moving air. So the gas exchange happens in the placenta. So there's not a lot of blood mass in the lungs. So those three factors together, the smallness of it, the fact that the baby's height, the baby's body is mostly upper body rather than lower body, and the water surrounding it, mean that you don't get the pooling in their head.
Right, okay. So it kind of like there is blood in their head. It's just that there's so little of them that it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah, they are getting a big fat blood supply to their head and they're trying to grow stuff like crazy. So at this stage, I think, giving unwanted advice, the baby is still kind of a few months preemie in a sense that they haven't learned how to sleep. Does your baby sleep at all?
Only during the day. Nighttime's not a favourite.
That's the law of maximum inconvenience. You got to pick a time to sleep. Sleep at night when I sleep. Oh, I don't know.
Exactly. But she's pretty cute. So.
Oh, we'll allow it. Alice, congrats. Thank you so much for asking your question.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks so much. Yay. Thanks, guys.
Andrew in Ngunnawal Country. Andrew, what do you want to know?
Hi, Dr. Carl. So I've been living in Canberra for about the better part of 20 years now, and I've just noticed over that period that when the weather transitions from normal ambient temperatures down to around the 2, 3 or even 0 degree mark indoors, I notice a sudden deposit of dust around the house particularly. And so I'm just wondering whether atmospheric dust suspension undergoes a similar process to, say, condensation or something like that. When the temperature first drops, that very first drop between, warmer weather and cold weather, you really notice this coating everywhere.
And how do you notice it? Is it that you're vacuuming or wet mopping the floor or cleaning the bathrooms? How do you notice there's more dust? What's the indicator for you?
The main indicator for me, I guess, is that areas that you wouldn't normally notice dust visually, you suddenly see a lot on. So I'm thinking like the cooktop, for example, where there's a little bit of oil and the contrast is pretty measured. And you're not used to having to clean dust up from your oily cooktop. But just all the other surfaces too, like your TV, where you notice the contrast with the blackness of the on the screen.
You're talking a man who has recently got hold of a vacuum wet and dry, which can do cold water, hot water, and even steam. And I have fallen in love with cleaning the floors after the babies come in the house, and I love seeing the huge amounts of dirt. So firstly, I think that what is happening is something related to thermodynamics, in the same way that water droplets are more visible coming out of your mouth on a cold morning. They're moving less quickly, and they're less likely to stay suspended, and they're more likely to coagulate because they'll come together and go apart, come together and go apart. If it's hot, they got more energy, they're more jiggling, they'll come apart. But if it's cold, when they accidentally stick together, they stay stuck. So I'm guessing that that's a factor. I haven't heard of this thing that you've mentioned, that it seems to be a jump over point, a sudden change at around, you're saying, the 2 to 3 degree outside air temperature. That's an interesting thing. I can see a paper being written on that for the Ig Nobel Prize. The second thing is that, to my surprise, there is a lot of dust in the air. So we collect the water from our roof, and we've got the equivalent of an underground swimming pool, 40,000 litres in the backyard, and you can't see it, just walk over it. And I've got various filters on the outside to clean the water before it goes in. There's a 1 millimetre mesh, 200 micron mesh, and a 100 micron mesh, which means it's just a little bit bigger than your hair. And each day when it's been raining after a while, so the dirt that's on the roof has been washed off, and now we're just getting the dirt in the air. On a good rainy day, typically, I'll get a volume of dirt from the roof area of our house the size of a chicken egg. And you look up in the air and you don't see it, but I'm picking it up in the filters, and there's still some dirt particles smaller than that getting past the filters, but I was astonished by how much dirt there is in the air. And we live in a clean country.
Yeah.
But,
it's one lifelong lesson of science. It's just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my guess. And if anybody's got a better answer, give us a ring on 0439 757 555.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you, Dr. Andrew.
Thank you.
You also threw it out there to an astronomer to potentially text in. Now, I don't know if this person is working in astronomy, but they said Venus, our question earlier about why Venus is so bright. Venus is at about 90 degrees to us in relation to the sun, so it's probably the highest point it gets in the sky at the moment, so the sky is darker there. Seeing Mercury, Jupiter and Venus in a row in the evening at the moment is beautiful. That's from Paul, a tradesman in Brisbane.
Thank you so much, Dr. Paul. There's a lot to unpack there, because also the closer that you're looking at Venus to the horizon, you're looking through more air. So if you look straight up, you're looking at what would they call an air mass of 1. And when you're looking on the horizon, it's about 45. And if it's a little bit above the horizon, it's maybe 40. So you're looking through less air, and so it would appear brighter. There's a whole lot of factors I hadn't even thought of. Thank you so much with your wonderful answer.
0439 757 555. Send in your questions now for Science with Dr. Carl. We've got a few left, just like Maria in Sydney did. Dr. Maria, what do you want to know?
Hi, Dr. Carl. Hi, Dr. Lucy. My question is, how come, I guess, the top half of our body feels the cold more so than the bottom half? I've noticed this a lot in winter. Like, I wear one layer of pants and it's fine for my legs, but for my top, I need, like, at least 2 or 3 layers, because for some reason, 7 degrees to my top half feels different to my bottom half.
Agreed, Maria. Often I'll only wear a thermal top. I won't need to wear thermal leggings. Dr. Carl, why is that?
Okay, so you don't feel the cold so much on your upper body, but you do on your lower body.
No. The other way around.
You feel the cold more on your lower body, so you on the upper body. You're feeling it more, so you have to wear extra layers on the upper body. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
Now, I was just thinking about this from a thermodynamic point of view, not bringing in the physiology, and I've come up with the opposite answer, which is wrong, which shows that my thinking is incorrect.
Wait, so what did you think?
Well, this goes against experience. I'm just trying to ignore what I actually feel in the real world, and I'm following basic science, like the example of assume a spherical cow, and then you go on from there. A cow's not spherical. So with your upper body, you've got relatively low surface area and a fair amount of mass, and the mass is generating heat, and it's only getting out to a relatively small area. So you'd think you'd lose more heat from the upper body, but in fact it's the other way around. And then with your legs, they're fairly skinny. They've got a lot of surface area, so you'd think you'd lose more heat, and you'd need to wear more clothes on the lower body, but in fact it's the other way around. Number one, I don't know, so let's go into physiology. So the physics doesn't work for me. I'm getting something wrong. I'm guessing it's because you've got those temperature sensors, the belly button and the nipples, but that's only when you're getting into the water. Mm. I don't know. I agree with you, and I don't know what I've got wrong in my thinking. You've raised a very deep question I've never thought about. That is a wonderful question.
Thank you.
That's the cover-up. I don't know the answer.
Brandon in Adelaide. Dr. Brandon, what's your question?
Yeah, g'day, doctors. I was just wondering, how do scientists obtain like a single atom? Are they just looking underneath the microscope and plucking it out with a pair of tweezers, or?
Atoms are hard to move around, and we can do it with various ways. So one thing you can do to the atoms is you can hit them with a big electrical charge. So you can get two metal plates, and you can put a lot of positive voltage on one side, negative voltage on the other side, and then you can end up with electrons being ripped off atoms. Then you can get those atoms, now that they've got an electric charge, you can control them with magnetic fields. So a hadron is a particle made of quarks. So the Large Hadron Collider can get these usually hydrogen ions and then charge them, and then have a series of plates where they build up speed, and then they direct them into a circle with big magnetic fields. The trouble is that they're going so fast, you can't just have a circle a metre across. It's got to be about 20 kilometres across. It's absolutely huge. At one stage, they're talking about trying to get one 100 kilometres across, where we can explore different areas of the energy band involved in the atoms that make us up. So you get these hydrogen ions, and according to Brian Cox from memory, when they get up to 99.999991% of the speed of light, 1 second for them is 11 months for us.
Wow.
They're moving so close to the speed of light that they change, their time slows down. And then philosophically, what they're trying to do is like trying to work out what's inside a watch, and you can't get inside it. So what you do is you get a whole lot of watches and you throw them at each other, and they break open, and you find there's a cog here, and there's a little bit of bearing there, and a little bit of oil. And so you throw them at each other. You have two beams going in opposite directions, and they cross over, and they bang into each other, and then you have these big sensors that maybe the size of a 3- or 4-story building that then try to analyse what the different charged particles are coming off. And from this, we can go back in time. And what we've worked out is that thing called gravity is conferred upon us by a particle called the Higgs particle. And because I've read too much science fiction, I kind of hope that one day we'll work out how to keep everything in the human body the same except for the Higgs field. So we'll have no mass, and our hearts will still beat blood, and our lungs will move air. But because we've got no mass, we can go to Mars in 8 minutes instead of 9 months, because we've got no mass. That's very much science fiction-y, but that's where I'm hoping we're heading for.
Yeah. Oh, that's wild. It's hard to get your head around.
Oh, it hurts my head. It still hurts my head that black holes have got no size, even though they have a mass 50 billion times the mass of our sun. It still hurts my head.
Yeah, it certainly does. Awesome. Thanks heaps for that, doctors. Appreciate you both.
Oh, thanks, Brandon.
We love you too.
Yeah, we've got Andrew in Ocean Grove. Andrew, what's happening in your yard?
Dr. Lucy, Dr. Carl, how are we today? I'm going to talk poop.
Hurrah! My granddaughter does that, so you'd be on the same page as her. She offers me poo-poo coffee from the bath when she's having a little bath, and then she tricks me and says, ha-ha, that was poo-poo coffee. So I'm expecting the same degree of intellectual coherence here.
That is a good
I'd say we probably are.
Okay, lay it on us.
So in my front yard, I've got my dog Banjo, and he drops his banjo bombs, and when I go to pick them up, there's all these bugs that come up out of the grass, and I've always sort of wondered, why are they there? What are they doing? I'm guessing it's about the nutrients in the soil, but if he's gone and there's no more poop, where do they go? What do they do?
They probably hibernate, or they lay eggs and then they die, and then some of the eggs will turn into, if you're lucky, dung beetles, but usually just house flies and the like, and then they'll die. And so if there's no food for them, eventually they'll die out. So part of the problem with Australia was that the animals that were here all had very open, fibrous poos. And then the Europeans came and brought all these animals with very concentrated poos, and we were having vast areas of Australia just covered with the poo. It was too concentrated. There were nutrients in there, but we didn't have the right sort of beetles to move them around. And so in the, I think it was around the 1960s, CSIRO started doing Meals on Wheels. They would then deliver dung beetles from Europe. They actually imported them from Europe, and they would go and get the cow poo and the horse poo, mainly cow poo, and then break it up into smaller pieces and put it into the ground. The dung beetles were thought by the ancient Egyptians to be workers for the gods, for the sun god Ra.
Yeah.
Because in the same way that the invisible sun god Ra would roll the sun across the sky, so too the dung beetles would roll little balls of poo across the ground. And recently we've discovered that the dung beetles in Australia that have been brought here actually at night will navigate by the Milky Way to find their favourite place, and then they can make more dung beetles. So in your case, I don't know what the individual insects are. You'd have to sort of get a bit yucky and get out there with a bit of sticky tape and catch them, and then find a tame entomologist and say, what's in my backyard?
I'll just go with dung beetles.
So the trouble with the dog poo is that it's too concentrated, and so it actually, and the cow poo burns the soil. We need the right sort of beetles to break them up, and apparently you've got them.
Oh, well, there we go. I guess I must have a healthy front yard.
Now, Carl, earlier we had a question from Maria who wanted to know why we're colder on the top half of our body. You know, maybe we're just wearing one layer of pants and then three layers on the top half. Evie texting in saying, could it be more nerve endings in the upper body, which is meant to protect our vital organs?
Interesting. I'd have to look that up. By the way, you have as many nerve endings on your thumb as you do on your entire back.
Crazy!
I know. So you can do the experiment with two fine metal pincers, and you get these points, and you feel it either as one or two points, so you can really feel the two different pointy things on your thumb easily. But on the back, they can be a centimetre apart, and you're only feeling one sharp thing.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Jace on the Northern Rivers wondering if, because our legs are doing more work supporting the whole show, if they are less susceptible to
Of course, forgot about that. They're always walking and moving you around and generating heat.
But Amy in Lansfield, Victoria, agreeing with you, Dr. Carl, saying, I wear thermals under my pants and it dispenses with the need to wear extra layers on top. The warm legs make my whole body warmer.
So she might be shunting blood. This is a complicated topic. So some straight physics doesn't answer it. We've got to get into physiology. Thank you so much.
That's it. We've got Benji in Aspendale here. Benji, you got a question about donating plasma.
I do, yeah. Morning, doctors. How are you both?
Good.
Amazing. I just wanted to know what kind of happens after I donate plasma and why I can only do it once a week, once a fortnight instead of once a week.
Firstly, Benji, thank you so much for donating plasma.
Yeah.
Oh, happy to do it.
And you're doing it for free.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you still get the cup of tea with the biscuit that you
get? Get a little snack.
Oh, always go for the biscuits.
Love that.
Right. Okay, so your blood is about 45% cells and 55% the salt water, which we call plasma. And you're giving away the plasma, not the red blood cells. I'm guessing you might give away the red blood cells every now and then, but mainly plasma?
I mainly just do plasma now, yeah, because I can do it every fortnight. So.
And do you have something wonderful in your plasma that people like?
I'm O positive in my blood type. I don't really know. I don't think so.
Okay, so the reason you can't do it every single day is that because of the chemicals. So the water can equilibrate fairly quickly. So you can, for example, drink a lot of beer, and then for every 200 mils of beer that comes in, 320 mils of urine goes out, and so you're getting dehydrated, and you can equilibrate and balance fairly quickly, but it's the chemicals. Now, some of those chemicals you can, you know, redress, you can replace the ones that you're giving away within a day or two, and some take weeks.
Right.
And so they're the ones that they're really after. So that's why I'm guessing they say only every 2 weeks. We have made great discoveries, like we discovered Rh negative, et cetera, in Australia with regard to giving blood, but we'll leave that to another time.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Benji. Thanks for your question. Dr. Carl, that's it. That's all we've got time for. Can you believe that?
Where did the time go? Flies.
I know.
What's the whole point of anything anyway if time goes so quickly?
Exactly. And that's it. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. If you haven't yet, I would highly recommend tapping back into last week's episode about all things gaming. Even if maybe you're not a gamer, that's not something that you do. There's so many interesting questions about the psychology of gaming, VR, some of the UX and why it is that way. Very, very cool stuff with Professor Marcus Carter from the University of Sydney. Go take a listen if you haven't yet. You can always catch up via the Science with Dr. Carl podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube, by the way, youtube.com/triplej. I'm Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan. We'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.